All right, we've come to Deuteronomy chapter 24. And I'll read the chapter. Deuteronomy 24. When a man marries a wife, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes, because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. No man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. If a man is found kidnapping any of his brethren of the children of Israel and mistreats him or sells him, then that kidnapper shall die, and you shall put away the evil from among you. Take heed in an outbreak of leprosy that you carefully observe and do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you, just as I commanded them. So you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. When you lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. You shall stand outside, and the man to whom you lend shall bring the pledge out to you. And if the man is poor, you shall not keep his pledge overnight. You shall in any case return the pledge to him again when the sun goes down, that he may sleep in his own garment and bless you, and it shall be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it, for he is poor and has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be sin to you. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. You shall not pervert justice due to the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore I command you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. Now, as some of the previous chapters, in this chapter there are a variety of topics, and if I tried to spend equal time on each of the verses, we would never get through it. So I thought I would focus first on verses 1 through 4, which have to do with divorce and a particular case of remarriage, because that's treated in the New Testament and is, I think, worthwhile for us to think about. And then I thought I'd summarize most of the rest of the chapter under the idea of treatment of the vulnerable or the defenseless. Some of the verses may not get much attention that way, but that's probably the best way to go through. Okay, so the first four verses have to do with a case of divorce and a forbidding of remarriage. We've already seen a couple of references in Deuteronomy to divorce, and there are other references in the Old Testament of people who have been divorced. That's the first couple of lines there. And so it's important for us to think about this. As I mentioned before, the law regulates divorce, and it's helpful for us to think about the relationship between that and God's original command. Okay, so the first thing you should do in reading any text, and especially the Bible, and especially here the first four verses, is look carefully at what it says. So what is the command in the first four verses of chapter 24? Well, there's no command in the first three verses. I'll give you that hint. The only command that's there is verse 4, her former husband must not take her back to be his wife. Okay? So, as we'll see, the Pharisees and others in Jesus' time misused these verses, twisted the meaning. The first three verses don't say that a man is supposed to divorce his wife. Okay? It says when a man takes a wife and marries her, and so on, and when he gives her a certificate of divorce, and when she is departed, and if the second husband detests her, and so on and so on. Okay? So just reading the verses, the command that this passage addresses is remarriage in a very special situation. Remarriage of a woman who has been divorced by her first husband. She remarries. Her second husband either dies or divorces her. And the question is, can she go back to her first husband? And the answer is no. Okay, so it's a very, very narrowly worded restriction that's covered here. That's the first thing. And note in particular that it doesn't say that she can't remarry a third person. Okay, it only says that she can't remarry her first husband. Now, why is this restriction here? Well, it's not really spelled out here. There are lots of comments that people have given, and when you read the comments, you start to realize how inventive, well, not the commentators are, but how inventive the wicked mind of man is, all the reasons why a man might profit from this circumstance. But if I could summarize generally the reason this command is here, is to prevent divorce, or to discourage divorce. Especially it discourages a hasty divorce, because the man who says, "Well, I'm getting tired of this one woman. I think I'll get rid of her," doesn't have the option later of getting her back again. Okay, so at least it discourages that sort of hastiness in divorce, which sadly is common to many circumstances of divorce, and especially many men who act in a way to exploit their wives. So another way of looking at it is this is a protection from the woman who might be put off in that way. Now, in terms of more specific ways in which the woman might be harmed or the man might take advantage of her, commentators, as I said, have been fairly creative. After all, the man could get whatever divorce settlement or inheritance the woman had from her second marriage, right? If her second husband dies, she gets an inheritance from him. Whew, let's take her back again. She's richer than she was before. Yeah, I mean, like I said, there are all kinds of things that people might think of. I think the best summary I've read is in Kidner's, actually, the commentaries on Jeremiah, because Jeremiah refers to this passage. But it makes sense to me that especially this is against the practice of, well, what was used to be called wife swapping, or a man simply giving her his wife away for a while but expecting to get her back. And Kidner points out the destructive effect on society of that. He says this law was aimed against what would amount to virtually lending one's partner to another. For if an authoritarian husband could dismiss his wife and have her back when the next man had finished with her, it would degrade not only her, but marriage itself, and the society that accepted such a practice. So I think it's important to be reminded in these studies in Deuteronomy that often the book has in mind not simply the personal aspects of the relationship, although those are important, but also the effect on all of society, especially as this touches on the matter of marriage and the state's recognition of marriage and divorce. It's an important passage to keep in mind. We saw that last week and the week before, I think, but it's important to remember that. Now, whenever you see a passage like this in the Old Testament, which has to do with divorce, you should ask the question, well, how is this consistent with Jesus' teaching in the New Testament? And since Jesus' teaching in the New Testament points us back to the Old Testament, it's a question of how is this consistent with the original institution. So let's turn then to Jesus' teaching, and especially turn to Matthew chapter 19. I put up some other references in Matthew's Gospel one other in Matthew and one in Mark. But Matthew 19, verses 3 through 12. So the question is, how are we to understand this sort of commandment in the context of the way the Bible originally commands marriage and the way Jesus interprets and understands that application? So in Matthew 19, at verse 3, the Pharisees come to him, they test him, they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And before we read Jesus' answer, just notice what the Pharisees' response is in verse 7. Sorry, this is a little out of order, but this is to get back to what I said about the misuse of Deuteronomy 24 and to show the connection. The Pharisees said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Well, that's not what Deuteronomy 24 says, is it? There's no commandment to give a certificate of divorce and put her away. It's a regulation that has a command in terms of a specific situation. So Jesus is dealing with the Pharisees who, common with others in their time, twisted the law in Deuteronomy 24. And that's part of why Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard that it was said that a man can divorce his wife, but I say to you. He's not correcting the Old Testament there. He's correcting a twisted version of Deuteronomy 24 in particular. Okay, so after having said that, let's look at verses 4 and 5. Jesus, answering the Pharisees, doesn't say, forget that Old Testament stuff. He says, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So Jesus is saying the original institution of marriage in Genesis 1 and 2 was supposed to be that marriage would be a permanent relationship. And Jesus explains then in the verses that follow that the reason this doesn't happen, as he says in verse 8, is because of the hardness of their hearts. Now, specifically, the hardness of their hearts works out itself in many disastrous ways in marriage, but more generally, hardness of heart refers to the fall. This is the way God created it. This is the institution of marriage. It's supposed to be a permanent relationship. But because of the fall, that's not the way it functions in the world. And in particular, there are valid reasons for divorce if one of the spouses commits adultery. As Jesus notes in verse 9, that's a reason why the marriage could be broken. But that is due to the hardness of heart, right? The adultery itself is a result of the fall and the person's sinful nature. So my point in reading this passage is to see that Jesus doesn't tell us to ignore what the Old Testament says, and he helps us to understand how Deuteronomy 24 should be interpreted. It has to do with life in a fallen world. And in particular, if you remember let's go back to Deuteronomy 24. If you note in verse 24 the reason that's mentioned here, because he has found some uncleanness in her, could possibly have the same reference as what Jesus mentions in Matthew 19. It could be that he finds fornication in her. It's in the New Testament reference, it's the same word. So it could be that Deuteronomy 24 is actually dealing with an exception due to adultery or some kind of sexual uncleanness that the man finds in his wife. By the time of Jesus, there were actually two schools of thought among the Jews. One school of thought understood the uncleanness in a fairly restrictive sense and said that a man was allowed to divorce his wife in that way. The other school of thought saw uncleanness as almost anything, like burnt toast would qualify as a reason for a man to divorce his wife. And I'm not kidding, okay? So, not that they had toasters, but that it was something as minor as a meal that the man didn't like. So Jesus is dealing in the New Testament with a situation where men have so distorted the original institution of the law, and even the statement in Deuteronomy 24 as if it commands divorce, that he has to call men to what seems an impossibly high standard. I mean, even the apostles react and say, whoa, be better for a man not to marry. Jesus calls us to faithfulness in marriage and correctly interprets for us the Old Testament and the usage of the original institution. So, in short, the understanding of Deuteronomy 24 should be specifically about this regulation that a man shouldn't remarry. But it does remind us that when God deals with men, especially when the civil law deals with men in a fallen world, it has to recognize certain existing circumstances and deal with them. It doesn't approve of those circumstances, but it regulates those circumstances. And maybe an easy way to understand that is to go back to a couple of verses from last week. So in chapter 23, verses 17 and 18, among all the many embarrassing verses we looked at last week, was a reference to ritual prostitution. Okay, and it says that there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. That's verse 17. And then verse 18 says, if you have that position, then don't give your money to the temple. Okay, right? It just says you're not supposed to do that. And then it says, if you do that, use your money to the temple. For a frivolous example, I have a mower manual that says, don't mow when the grass is wet. And then a couple of paragraphs down, it says, if you're mowing when the grass is wet, you know, do this and this, like be careful or something like that. Well, okay, that's a frivolous example, but the law has to deal with the situation where men break the law. And that's really what Deuteronomy 24, I think, is talking about. Unless the uncleanness strictly refers to adultery as an exception, the law here probably has in view a situation where a man is unjustly acting toward his wife and then restrains the man from acting in that way. It's a little hard to know exactly because the word uncleanness isn't specified further here. But it's a good reminder that the law here has a specific focus and is not some pass to divorce, which the Pharisees and others in Jesus' time interpreted it to be. Now, this is not the first time in Deuteronomy that we've talked about sexual relationships and the abuse of sexual relationships, and I've felt many times that it's maybe not the most helpful thing for me just to talk about what's forbidden. It's better for us to think positively of the way God blesses the marriage relationship and his goodness to us. And so I thought maybe to help us here, it would be good to look at the way Christ relates to us as described in Ephesians 5. So before we go away from this short section of Deuteronomy, turn with me again to the New Testament, and this time to Ephesians 5. Verses 22 and 23 in particular. Well, beginning at verse 22, I'm not sure. That wasn't supposed to be 23. That was supposed to be 33. Can't read my own writing. Okay, I won't read the whole passage, but it begins, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." And here's especially the part relevant to Deuteronomy 24. "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. For he who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." So I'll stop there. But just think of the contrast here between the way that, if you want to call it liberal interpretation of Deuteronomy 24 functioned. If the wife did anything to offend you, you can get rid of her. She has any spot or blemish, if we could put it that way, she's gone. Versus the way Christ treats the church, which is that he loves the church, he loves us when we're unlovely, he takes us to himself, and his ultimate purpose is to present us as a glorious church, in verse 27, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that we would be holy and without blemish. Okay, that implies there are blemishes. There are plenty of wrinkles and blemishes in the bride of Christ. But instead of putting her aside for another, Christ lovingly sanctifies us and cleanses us by the word and sacrament and draws us to himself. That's a really helpful thing when you think of such an unpleasant subject as Deuteronomy 24 and divorce and the way wives were often abused. It's really encouraging to think instead of the way Christ loved the church and he saw the wrinkles and loved her, you might say, the more to give her holiness and growth and grace. And of course, the uncomfortable application for husbands is, so husbands ought to love their own wives. Okay? It's a high standard, but that's the way the Apostle Paul presents it, and he understands that we care for ourselves better than we care for others, so love their own wives as their own bodies. And so the implication is that the model that we should follow, instead of thinking of the least possible and the worst condition like Deuteronomy 24:4, okay, if all this happens, then don't take her back again, is to love your wife and not to be so picky with a spot or a wrinkle, but to seek her good and to nourish and cherish her. Count that sufficient on those four verses. That was 20 plus minutes. Any comments or questions on that part of Deuteronomy 24? Application of it. It really is good to remember that the law, when it forbids something, also commands the positive. The larger catechism, as we've noted several times, really is very helpful in that way. And so that's what I was trying to do with that last discussion. Okay, well, let's look then at the rest of the chapter. Okay, so here, as I said, I'm really going to focus on the theme of the treatment of the vulnerable or the defenseless. Let me just quickly make a couple of comments over on parts of this that don't really probably directly tie in. Verse 5 has to do with a man who is newlywed and he's not supposed to go to war, or it says be charged with any business. We saw earlier in Deuteronomy a restriction that even the one who is betrothed was not allowed to go to war, and this is along those lines. If this is care for the defenseless, that would have to do with the wife then, who would be losing her her new husband. But it's a little hard to tie that in with the rest of it. And then verses 8 and 9 have to do with leprosy. And as that's discussed at length in Leviticus 13 and 14, and we looked at that within the last decade or so, I'm not going to say anything more about that. There's plenty of other material here, so let's focus instead on the treatment of the fellow man, and especially the focus on those who are defenseless. Okay, so the first verse I'm going to focus on has to do with kidnapping in verse 7. If a man is found kidnapping any of his brethren. In Hebrew, the word is literally stealing, because kidnapping is stealing of a person. And the regulation here is if a man is found kidnapping, and other aspects of that, other, you might say, abuses, mistreating him and selling him are mentioned there, then, well, the regulation is that the kidnapper shall die. Kidnapping is a capital crime in Israel. And this fact that it's treated that way shows the seriousness of it before God. It's serious in part because it's a fellow Israelite, but it's serious in any case because a man is losing his freedom. In the case of a fellow Israelite, probably the person would be sold to someone outside of the land. And so the added difficulty, the added abuse is that the person lives among idolaters. He's put away from the people of God, just as David complains that when he was on the run from Saul, he was told really to go and serve other gods, at least implicitly, because he wasn't allowed to be treated as part of the people of God. So that's part of the aggravation, as they say, of kidnapping in this particular situation, is that the person would be really, in effect, cast off from the people of Israel. Now, kidnapping for the purpose of slavery is a long historical practice. It was the basis for slavery in America. That's where the slaves came from kidnapping in Africa. In our day, the practice of kidnapping isn't as much on the surface, but it's really what human trafficking is about. Human trafficking often for purposes of prostitution or for forced labor, apparently also for body parts. Don't really want to think about that, but this is still a problem in our day. It's a problem in our society. Apparently, Oklahoma interstates are a common place where this sort of trafficking occurs because of where the highways cross. So this is a serious thing still for people to think about. Kidnapping is a serious crime. Paul mentions it also in 1 Timothy 1:10. Let me go on then to other verses which I think fit together maybe a little bit more clearly. And these have to do with treatment of the poor specifically. If you're my age, then you watched, you know, the FBI in the 70s. It was a TV show, and typically they kidnapped people. But they didn't kidnap poor people because they wanted a ransom. Okay, here, this is verse 7 is probably not kidnapping a rich person. But the other verses more clearly tie into the need to care for the poor and needy. So one of the common themes here is the reference to the pledge. So look at verse 6, no man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. And then in verses 10 through 13, you shall not go into the house to get a pledge. This is someone you've loaned money to. You shall not go into his house to get a pledge. And then again at the last part of verse 17, you shall not take a widow's garment as a pledge. Okay, so what is the pledge? The idea is that the wealthy person loans the poor person money, and it's not unusual in a circumstance like that for the lender to seek some sort of what we call collateral. That is, there has to be some incentive for the person who's borrowed the money to pay the money back. Okay, and other than a moral incentive, there has to be an economic incentive. And so typically, there is collateral. Now, if you own a home, you know, your home could be collateral for another loan or something like that. Not a good idea, maybe, but that's not an unusual practice. But here, specifically, these are poor people. And the question is, how do you treat the pledge? How do you treat the collateral for the loan that is understood to be there? It's not forbidding the pledge or the collateral. It's a question of how is it that you are to treat the situation like that? And the basic point in all of this is that the person who's taking out the loan is living on the margins of life. Okay? He doesn't have a big bank account, he doesn't have a secure situation, or he wouldn't be doing what he's doing. And so the law has a special regard for the poor and needy, which is a very common theme in Scripture. Basically, the rest of the passages here on the board from Exodus 22:6-7, Amos, and so on, all the way down, that's a small sample of the verses in Scripture that have to do with the way we should treat the poor, and especially those who are in specifically vulnerable situations. Okay, so what does it say about it in each of these cases? Well, in the first case, it says in verse 6, not to take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living or one's life in pledge. Okay. So they couldn't go to Walmart and buy processed, you know, flour and that sort of thing. They had to grind their own, whatever it was they used to make bread. They had to basically grind to get their own flour. And so the law is that they couldn't take that away. Now, it's probably not specifically just that they wouldn't be able to eat that way. Probably the situation is that this is the way the man makes a living. That is, he is a person who grinds maybe for others. And so it's taking away not, you might say, his life only, but his livelihood, his means of making money. Okay. So, you know, have you ever thought about how stupid a debtor's prison is? I mean, how's the guy supposed to make money? Well, there were provisions for that. But this is like that sort of thing. How is the guy supposed to pay back the loan if you just took away his means of making a living? That's the point of the restriction. Taking one part of the millstone effectively does that, right? It doesn't matter whether you take the upper or the lower one. If you take one of them, the guy can't grind what he wants to grind. Now, in terms of what that means in our day, Well, most people probably don't have millstones by which they, you know, grind grain for the neighborhood. But Gary North gave an example. Suppose you have a guy, he owes you money, and you think it's a bright idea to take two tires away from his car. Okay. Well, then how's he going to get to work? That doesn't make any sense. But, as Gary North says, suppose he has a truck he uses for farming, but then he has a sports car that he uses on the weekend. Well, you can take the two tires from the sports car, right? Because it's just a frivolous thing. He's not making good use of his time. It would be acceptable because it's not his living to do that. But you shouldn't restrict the man in the way he's able to take his living by the way you take the pledge. So similar comments, shorter I hope, apply in the other situations that are mentioned here. It says in the next case in verses 10 and 11 that you can't go into his house and take your pick of his things for pledge. Okay, so here's the man who is making the arrangements for a loan. And the lender says, okay, well, let me go into your house and take my choice of your things as a pledge. And that's forbidden here. I'll come back to that in a minute in terms of the reason for that. But the other case that's mentioned here is verses 12 and 13, and that's taking the person's garment. Okay, now this has to do with the cloak. Again, we're talking about a poor person. The poor person living in that climate probably didn't need his cloak during the day if he was working, but that's all he had to keep him warm at night, and it did get cool at night in that situation. And so the lender is not supposed to take that garment away from the poor person at night. He can take it during the day, but you're supposed to return it, it says, when the sun goes down, so that the person can sleep in his garment. Is that understandable? It's a fairly simple regulation. I don't think I explained it very well, but that's the point. Now, in each of these cases, there's a limitation on the ability of the lender, or of the, maybe we should say, of the lender-debtor relationship. He doesn't have absolute authority over the person from whom he's borrowed. The scriptures say, you know, the borrower is a servant to the lender, which is in effect often the case, but it's not an absolute servitude. And in particular, one point that many commentators note is these all have the effect of preserving the dignity of the borrower. Okay, this person is on the edge. A person in that situation often can feel that he has limited value in society, maybe limited value to his family. But in each case, the emphasis is on the fact that the lender, the rich man, isn't supposed to humiliate the poor man. And that's certainly part of what's going on when he says, don't go into his house. The man's house is his castle. Okay, you're not going to go in there and just see what he has and chuckle over how bare his cupboards are or something like that and take the best thing you can. Instead, you're to show respect for the person and respect the dignity that God has put in him. Now that idea of preserving the dignity really applies to many of the other parts of this passage, but I think it's especially important in connection with the pledge. Let's look at the other aspects, and since they do fit pretty well together. The next one is about prompt payment. That's verses 14 and 15. It says, you shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy. But then it gives a specific way in which you're not to oppress them or in which they might have been oppressed. And that has to do with prompt payment of wages. Each day you shall give him his wages. So you may think of the parable that Jesus tells in the New Testament of how the men worked out in the fields for a day and then at the end of the day they came to get paid. Okay, we're not used to that. People are paid every other week or monthly or something like that. But again, this is a different society. People are living on the margins. They don't have a lot of resources. If you don't pay him at the end of the day, he might not have anything to eat for breakfast. Okay? And that's the idea of this. It's again the showing respect for the person. Gary North points out that in effect, if you don't pay him at the end of the day, then you're forcing him to give you credit Here you are, the wealthy person, and you're forcing the poor person to loan you money, in effect, that is holding off in payment of the wages. This sort of thing, again, is mentioned elsewhere in the scriptures, in James 5. So in the New Testament in particular is a reference to the abuse of workers by those who withhold wages, whether it was paid on a daily basis or not. It's still a call to be just and fair in dealing with others. The other case that's mentioned here in the chapter is that of gleaning. Gleaning is mentioned in verses 19 through 22. Okay, so we talked about Ruth not that long ago, not just within the last decade, in the last year or so. And in the book of Ruth, I think you can see the practice of gleaning come to life, but the basic commandment is that you shouldn't be super efficient when you're harvesting. Okay, so when you're harvesting and you see you left behind some grapes, leave them there. And that's so that the poor, and there are three classes mentioned here repeatedly, and I want to come back to this. It says the stranger, so this is the foreigner who lives among them, the fatherless, and the widow. Especially those three should be able to come and gather up. Now, this also preserves the dignity of the person. You might say it preserves the dignity of the person better than just a handout would, because the person is treated as someone who can do work, even if it's at a limited way, and provide for himself or a widow herself. So this, again, fits in with the theme of care for those whose life is at the margin, and it is does command a certain inefficiency, but on the other hand, from the point of view of society as a whole, it really is an efficient way of dealing with the harvesting of crops. One other case is mentioned, and it's a little bit hard to fit it in, and that is, well, at least the first instance of it is in verse 16, and that has to do with the innocent being put to death. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. So this has to do with a specific legal situation where if a father is convicted of a capital crime, then the child is killed, maybe in addition to the father or instead of the father. This was practiced in some parts of the ancient Near East, and it's specifically forbidden here. There's one account in the later Kings. It's actually appears twice in 2 Kings 14 and 2 Chronicles, where it says the king didn't put to death the family of those who had killed his predecessor because of this law, specifically. Now, there are questions that arise because God talks about, for example, showing mercy to thousands, but the third and fourth generation of those who are idolaters will receive his wrath. There are questions like that that come out. I decided I didn't have enough time to talk about it, so if you want to ask about that, you could. There are other questions that come up in connection with the chapter, too. But that's you can think of as a way to protect the vulnerable. The child is not a guilty party, so the child should not be put to death because the father has committed a capital crime. But specifically, let me note again in verse 17, I said I would come back to this, there's a call more generally for justice for the stranger and the fatherless, and then it mentions taking the widow's garment as a pledge. So these people are especially vulnerable in a court of law because they have no power in the community. They have no natural allies. So as Matthew Henry says about them, the judges must be advocates for those that cannot speak for themselves and have no friends to speak for them. So I think that's why these people are especially singled out. Never should injustice occur, and that's part of the law. But in particular, there's a danger of abuse and injustice in the case of the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And that's why that's mentioned here. Okay, so I want to step back then, that's as brief as I could discuss, some of the ways people are supposed to care for the vulnerable, not mistreat the defenseless. But it's important to step back and think about, first of all, how God surrounds those laws with incentives and disincentives, and also to think about, in terms of the gospel, how that the gospel we saw affected the way we think about marriage. The gospel also affects the way we think about the stranger and the needy. So first, let's look at the positive incentives. Verse 13, if you treat this poor person in this way, in particular if you return his cloak to him so that he can wrap himself in it at night, he will bless you. Okay? This is a way of saying that the poor person's prayers are heard by God just as much as the rich person's prayers, and you should seek his prayers on your behalf. You should seek that he would pray for you and bless you. And then it says specifically in verse 13, it shall be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. Okay, so that's another one of those things we could talk about. But we could go into a discussion of justification, but let me say simply, it means that God approves of this dealing with the person. God approves of the blessing of the poor man in return by returning the cloak to him. God's favor is shown. And this is said in different ways in different parts of the scripture. Proverbs 19:17 is a familiar and memorable statement. The one who lends to the poor lends to the Lord, and God will repay him. Okay, so there are lots of incentives in the scripture, lots of blessings associated with caring for the defenseless. Verse 15, on the other hand, talks about the disincentives for abusing the poor. Each day you shall give him his wages, lest he cry out against you to the Lord and it be sin to you. Okay? So he might not bless you. Instead, he might cry out to God for justice, and God will treat it as not righteousness, but as sin against his law. And that's the sort of thing James talks about in James 5, that the cries of the laborers come up before the Lord. And it's a very serious thing. But I'd like especially to focus on two parts of this passage that are easily overlooked. And that has to do with the reference twice. It's not two parts. It's two references to God redeeming them out of Egypt. So, do you notice that in verse 18? You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. In verse 22, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. Okay. In short, God is saying, if I could use a New Testament term, that the gospel affects the way we treat the vulnerable and the needy. It's the gospel to them, the good news of their redemption out of Egypt. But it's not very hard for us to make the connection between that good news and the good news of the gospel for us. If anything, it would make us more generous and more caring for those who are needy. But it's worthwhile just thinking through how the fact that they were slaves and God redeemed them affects the way they look at the vulnerable. It's so worthwhile that Calvin took basically a whole sermon on this, and I was tempted just to read it to you, but probably wouldn't do you a lot of good, but I mean, because it would be so long. But it's a very worthwhile thing to think about. First of all, at the most basic level, they should treat the vulnerable in a kind way because they were vulnerable once. Right? They know what it's like to be mistreated. They know what it's like to make bricks without straw. They know what it's like to live on the margin. And therefore, they should show mercy to the poor. But it goes beyond that, because they weren't left in that state. God showed mercy to them. So if they have received mercy, then certainly they should show mercy to others. If they have this abundance, they should give generously to those who don't have abundance, because they have received a far greater mercy than material possessions. They have received the redemption that has to do with salvation. Egypt was a place of darkness and idolatry, and God took them out and was giving them a land in which they could worship him purely. But it goes even beyond that. It goes to the fact that when God took them out of Egypt, he was, as I said, giving them a land in which they could earn wealth. We talked about this in Deuteronomy 8, right? When they enter the land, they would be tempted to think that they were self-sufficient. And the temptation of the self-sufficient, the person who thinks, I earn this money myself, is to say, well, that wretch obviously isn't working hard enough because he's poor. But the attitude that God encourages here is to remember, if If God redeemed you, if God gave you this land, then God is the one who gives you power to get wealth, and therefore God should cause you to be caring toward those who don't have wealth. God should cause you to act, as it were, in his place. And here, okay, so I will read a bit of what Calvin says in connection with this, because he talks about how God is essentially asking those who have resources to act in his place to care for the poor. How much of this should I read? If God gave me no more than I needed, yea, if I had not a crumb of bread more than would feed me, yet that were very much, and I could never discharge myself of my duty to magnify him sufficiently for his bountifulness and goodness towards me. But when he gives a man more than he needs, he appoints him after a sort to represent his own person, as if he should say, whereas it is my property to do good, this is God speaking, for all good things proceed from me. It is I which make the earth to yield fruit. It is I which do give its strength to bring forth her fruits. I do, as it were, give him mine own office, and assign him to be, as it were, my lieutenant. And how great an honor is that? So God gives the person who has resources, as it were, an office, as a, he calls him a lieutenant here, to act on God's behalf. And Calvin's conclusion is, all the riches, therefore, All the rich, therefore, which have wherewith to do good, are doubtless, as it were, the officers of God to exercise that which is properly belonging unto him, namely, to help their neighbors to live. Now, that has to do fundamentally with faith in God, right? It's easy to say, I don't have enough resources to give to others. It's easy to be covetous and say, well, if I give this away, then I won't have enough for myself, and I want more grapes in my field, so I'm going to reap them to the edges. But the fact that God provides for us, God has redeemed us, God cares for us, God provides for us, means that we can be free to trust him and to care for those who are needy. We can bless others because we are content with what God has given us. That's the sort of argument Paul makes in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, where he says, Christ, who was rich for our sakes, became poor, and says, because of the riches we have in Christ, we can therefore give freely to others. So I wanted to bring that up because it's one thing to say, well, just that poor guy on the street, I really feel sorry for him. But it's another thing to remember that God has redeemed us, God has saved us by his grace, and as Moses says here, because God has redeemed us, therefore he commands us to do these things. Okay. Any thoughts in connection with this? Yes, Vicky.
In modern applications, or just in general, are we talking about the poor and needy within the body of the church? Or is this just in society in general?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So the fatherless and the widow probably would be from among their own people, and that would be the implication. The stranger was someone who lived among them but probably wasn't converted to the God of Israel. So then he would be your neighbor, but he wouldn't be a believing neighbor. And there is a call here to show some level of mercy. That's right, you know. I think what Paul says in the New Testament applies, first within the household of faith, but show good to all men. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, and I just think it's more complicated because we also are dealing with the government system of charity and right. The tendency to generalize, well, they're not working hard or there are these other problems, and so it doesn't seem to engender the same feeling of humility and helpfulness on our part.
Yeah, and in many cases those programs don't actually engender dignity either and make what we were talking about at the first part of the chapter even worse because you don't have stable families and so on. So it is a very difficult circumstance to deal with, I agree. Yes, Dan?
Well, to that end, I was noticing the passage doesn't seem to indicate that you shall sit back and let the government take care of all these things for you. For your mother. It seems to indicate you shall take care of
right.
And show respect and honor. So, that combined with, say, the parable of the Good Samaritan, where interestingly, it was the Jew who was in the pitch, and it was the Samaritan who had money and didn't just wait for a government program worker to come by and take care of that guy.
Right.
There's a lot that could be said. But
yeah, that's very good.
But it was supported by the government of the time, because the judges were encouraged.
Right. Now, it is part... Yeah, there are judicial laws tied into this in terms of the whole system is supposed to support the poor and needy so that they don't make it worse by abusing the father and the fatherless and the widow and the stranger. Yeah, that's very good. And John?
Yes, I would like to ask about verse 16.
Is that one of those I skipped over, John? Yeah.
No, I actually have the example of the guy that sins and then his whole family is put to death.
Right.
That's what immediately came to mind. So I guess my question is, would this be more from like a human, like the actual law court or whatever that he's putting in place, as opposed to like God's judgment on a family?
Yes. Okay. That's better than I could have said it, but that's right. So God knows the hearts of men. When God puts to death the children of idolaters, it's because the children themselves are idolaters. I mean, God can extend his judgment in ways that no civil magistrate can. So this is a restraint upon, you know, I knew you're old man and I'm going to get you too, sort of attitude that could exist in a society. It's simple. If the person is guilty of the crime, he suffers for it, but his family is not directly supposed to suffer for the crime.
Yeah. I figure it has something to do with, you know, God knows the hearts of men. You know, we don't...
Right.
The whole original sin thing, we all know that no one is truly innocent.
Exactly. That's the basis for God's action in the other cases that you think of in connection with that. Yeah. The civil magistrate, in spite of what he might think about himself, doesn't know the hearts of men and is therefore restrained from acting. Yes.
Fast forward to that. We were just reading this week in Daniel. Darius, we know he made this foolish decree, but then he was up all night hoping for Daniel, and he made this great statement about the Lord, but then he killed all the... He had the satraps thrown in the lion's den, and their wives and children, too, so you know,
yeah.
It's common in that society, and here he was, even after that testimony from the Lord, he went and executed the entire family of the men who had done this.
It was a brutal society to live in, especially when it was just on the whim of the king, said, throw in the wives and kids, too. Yeah. Okay, let's close in prayer.